This season of Real History is brought to you by the Real History Patrons. Join now to support the show at patreon.com/realhistorypodcast. Welcome to Real History, shows what you know about history. On this podcast, we talk about historical movies and television shows, anything that claims to be based on a true story, and we check how bad did they mess it up? What was life actually like during that time period? Well, that's why we're here, to separate the real history from the real history. My name is Jacob Burrows, and I don't know anything about history.
And my name is Michael Tynan, and I'm just wanting to say, huzzah!
My name is Mark, and I am very much the Marshall Ney to Michael's Napoleon.
Ooh, Jesus, that's saying a lot. Yeah, don't know how I feel about that, as we'll go into.
It's not saying a lot to me, but that's why we're here, to learn whatever these two are talking about. That's pretty much what we do here. So welcome to part one of our Napoleon coverage. The three-part series in this season, season four, we're talking about Ridley Scott's epic historical drama, Napoleon. Now, I guess one sentence summary, that's where we should start. So the way I've described the movie is a military man tries to impress his wife by rising up to rule and expand an empire that crumbles under the weight of his ambition.
Tries to impress his wife. Look.
I mean, that's kind of how...
That's the premise, the angle Ridley Scott is.
As he would say,
taken.
You weren't there, so shut the fuck up.
That's a very good quote as well from good old Ridley. Now, we had to do three episodes because it's really, I think three is going to be tough to fit everything in. And we're not going to fit everything in, really.
No, despite my best efforts. I really want to cover everything, but I don't think it's going to be possible.
I did say in a previous episode that we were going to talk about this to buckle up. So I hope, listener, you are buckled up.
Yeah, this is going to be... A fairly big one. Michael's been researching this for about a year?
For about his whole life.
Yeah. Well, this particular era, I suppose. Not like Napoleon, you know, people have very different opinions on him, as we'll see, and we'll try and be balanced as ever. But the era in itself, I suppose, it's capturing... You know, a lot of enlightenment ideas that are coming to fruition. You've got, obviously, the backdrop of the French Revolution beforehand. You're talking about a series of, you know, continental wars, which stem from this seismic event, you know, in 1789. And I suppose because of that, it's hard not to be fascinated by this era, whatever you think about Napoleon.
Yeah, I would just say, like, broadly in the study of history, there's kind of two, like, traditionally there's kind of two camps. There's the great man theory, and then there's sort of like the great forces theory. Mm. And if you were someone who was standing, if you were defending the great man theory, Napoleon is exhibit A. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, I would rate Napoleon, just so my colours are nailed to the mast here, like, I would rate Napoleon in, like, the top 10 most consequential people to have ever lived in any country in any era. I put him that, like, Jesus, Mohammed.
He's a singular figure, like...
Like, Caesar, he's that level of a person. Like, the very fact that anyone listening to this has heard his name, irrespective of whether they like history, that says a lot. And you've heard his first name. He's known by his first name. You know, those things are important. You know?
When we'll get into it, obviously, but when he returned from exile originally in 1815, and he had his famous 100 days again, one of his marshals at the time said that no one had ever retaken their empire in history just by turning up in that hat. Yeah. Because, you know, that acorn hat, everybody knows it, and that silhouette. And as we'll go into, Napoleon was very conscious of his image. And, he, you know, he was one of the greatest propagandists in history, as we'll learn. And he knew how to cultivate an image. Like, he was so steeped, I suppose, in classical thinking. Like, one of his big hero, surprise, surprise, was Julius Caesar. You know what I mean?
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Everyone's shocked. Yeah. I would just like to say, when I name my colors to the mast, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with the great man theory of history.
I was going to say, even if you're subscribed to the forces view, this is talking about what drives historical development and great events, right? Yes, so but even if you're thinking about the great forces and clashes, that's also going to be this time period. It's still going to be an extremely interesting time.
Of course, yeah. I was just saying, like, you know, if that's your argument, if you are a great man theorist, Napoleon is your first go-to guy, I would say.
Yeah. It's a bit of a slippery slope from the old great man theory into fascism, but, you know, that's just... what isn't these days? Yeah. let me tell you a bit more about the film before we start getting into even more of Napoleon and his character. So, Ridley Scott, he announced this film on the same day he wrapped The Last Duel, filming of The Last Duel in 2020.
He never stops this one.
No, he's prolific, isn't he?
Incredible, really.
Yeah. Very much so, and I think part of it is he has sort of his a stable of folks, both actors and like production people, who kind of work with him in his production company. So you'll see recurring names here. It's directed by Ridley Scott, of course, written by David Scarpa, who actually got started writing The Last Castle, which we have reviewed on Cut to Black, me and Jim, because it stars James Gandolfini. Mm. It's a weird step from that to this.
It is.
But he did, him and Ridley Scott seem tight. They worked together on All the Money in the World. And from there, he's become like his partner in writing. He wrote this and he's writing Gladiator 2 as well. Production folks, I'm not going to, there's, you know, the usual kind of folks you see producing these movies. Cinematography, you have Darius Wolski, who is a Polish cinematographer. You'd know him from Pirates of the Caribbean, from Dark City back in the 90s, and Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. But since 2012, he's been a Ridley Scott man. He did The Martian, The Last Duel, Exodus. Like, he does cinematography for Ridley Scott. Exodus. He's the reason they look like that.
Yeah, Exodus, dreadful film. Cinematography is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fairness to Ridley Scott, like, whatever criticisms we do dish out in this, like, visually, hit this film, as are most of his films, are just beautifully
fantastic,
shot.
Like
there's battle scenes in this which, you know, will live long in the memory. You know?
There's a little bit too much blue filter in this one.
Oh my God, it's a European film though. It's got to have blue.
No, just come on.
This is why we like A Knight's Tale. It's got color, unlike every other historical film set in Europe.
We, like,
in I'm saying we, the real history production,
the collective we.
I'm outvoted in this.
The imperial we. So it was edited by Claire Simpson and Sam Restivo. So Claire Simpson has worked with Ridley Scott as well on All the Money in the World, The Last Duel, The House of Gucci, Gladiator 2. You know, it's the same kind of folks. Music's by Martin Phipps, who has not worked with Ridley Scott before, but has composed for many historical TV shows, like adaptations of Jane Austen. And
yeah, that's not surprising when you hear the score, actually.
Yeah,
it's not surprising.
Did the music for The Crown, Peaky Blinders, like a lot of different stuff. But getting into the cast, of course, we have Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby as the two, the two main characters, right?
Yeah, the two only characters in the film.
Kind of the two only characters, Napoleon and Josephine. I have a long cast list here. So we have Tahar Rahim, who plays Paul Barraz, a politician, head of the directorate, or the directory. Rupert Everett is the Duke of Wellington. Now, he is the voice of Prince Charming in Shrek 2. And you would also, of course, know him as Dr. Claw, the bad guy in the 99 live-action Inspector Gadget.
Wow.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I will take your word for that one.
Ben Miles appears in this. I know him well from Coupling. He's also Peter Townsend in The Crown. He plays Armand Gallancourt. And look, I could keep listing people. We have Matthew Needham as Napoleon's brother. He's in the House of the Dragon as Laris Strong, the guy with the sort of limp in there. I could.
Oh yeah.
It's a long cast list, but I think that what we said kind of covers it. That they all blur together for me, even watching the film. They're not really that important, are they?
To generally an astonishing degree, they're so unimportant in the film. It's really a two-hander.
I think the biggest problem, and like just little caveat, I suppose, like because we will be going into this film's inaccuracies as well. Obviously, our main aim is going to be to discuss the Napoleonic era, but like Ridley Scott was very clear that this was an ahistorical movie. Like when he did not claim that it was going to be a biopic. So like he definitely kept his word in terms of accuracy because like one of Napoleon's biographers, especially in the English speaking world, one of them is Andrew Roberts, who wrote a biography about 10 years ago, Napoleon the Great. And he was asked how much of the film is accurate. And he was like, being generous, 30%, you know?
Wow.
So it is like, there's some shockingly bad stuff in this, but what I would suppose is what really sticks to you is you don't understand throughout this film why anything is happening.
Yeah, that's the key.
You know, there's very little context. It's very much just event after event after event. And because of that, you're a bit lost, especially if you don't have some sort of knowledge. Like, you could easily be led to believe that Napoleon is just a numbskull, you know, just bent on impressing his wife, as he said, and conquering as many countries, but without any overarching strategy or anything like that. And I think that's the biggest injustice.
You don't even know where you are in the film. Like, when the battles are happening, you don't know where you're in them. You don't know where it is. You don't know why he's there. You don't know who's fighting even sometimes. It's just not that clear, you know?
No.
Yeah.
And it's okay for me, or for certainly for Michael, if you're watching that and you kind of go, oh, that's this battle, and you know, because of, you know, whatever it might be, the weather, or, you know, you can tell by the uniforms that the opposition soldiers wear, whatever it might be, you might be able to tell. But like, if you're not a big history nerd, or you're not a big Napoleonic era nerd or whatever, like, you'd be forgiven for not understanding where anything takes place at any stage except for the start and kind of the end.
You mentioned as well, Mark, that Ridley Scott, Napoleon, maybe he does have a Napoleonic complex, I don't know. But Ridley Scott, when he was asked about this, you know, about the historical accuracy of the film, and he was like, well, were you there? Which is like a real bullish thing to say, you know, really taunting historians, so to speak.
Well, yeah, the full quote being, when I have issues with historians, I ask, excuse me, mate, were you there? No? Well, shut the fuck up then.
But like, basically, you could say that about any of our lives, that we shouldn't speak about anything historically that didn't begin from the day we were born ourselves then. Yeah. Like, it doesn't make any sense, that thing. What I would say is that, like, he could, if he wanted to do a film that examined the great romance of Josephine and Napoleon, which it was, it's one of the most famous romances in history, he could have done sort of a Woody Allen kind of, semi-serious sort of thing.
I'd argue that's what he should have done, actually. Yeah.
And call it Napoleon and Josephine or something like that. Not Napoleon, because it just will give the false impression that this is the truth.
It gives the impression that he's trying to show everything, but in reality, he doesn't show anything.
He left a lot of that up to David Scarpa, actually. Initially, like, he didn't necessarily come into it with, like, I want to do something about Napoleon and Josephine. But David Scarpa, he didn't have much knowledge about Napoleon before this and started looking into it. And he realized basically the same thing we did about this podcast, that it's very difficult to cover his whole life, right? Yeah. So he was like, we will argue about like how well they did it, but the thing was like, okay, we can't do his entire life. Let's focus in on Napoleon's relationship with his wife. I have a fun quote where he started by reading David Bell's biography, Napoleon, A Concise Biography. And he says, it was about 100 pages long. Oddly, I found myself having more questions coming out of it than answers. And that's not surprising, because only 100 pages isn't really enough to delve into it, which is why it's challenging for us as well to summarize what we're going to summarize here. But yeah, he kind of made the decision, like, let's focus in on that. And Ridley Scott, you know, he's fucking always making 7 movies. He's like, yeah, let's do that. Let's go. And also, the writer thought maybe we'll have 30 million doing this film. And that would probably have been a more Woody Allen type film.
Yeah.
But no, Apple Studios came in. Here, do you want 100 million? And that's what you see up on the screen. That's why the battles are so big. It's kind of turned it into this epic scope where they renamed it from the sort of in production development name was Kit Bag, and they changed that to Napoleon then, because it's like, well, it's so epic, we kind of have to name it that. And it doesn't really cover all of it. You can't really. But anyway, yeah, as far as the film itself, it was released November 22nd, 2023. And it's by the time you listen to this, it will also be on Apple TV. That's coming out March 1st. And as far as how it's done okay-ish. It earned $220 million in box office. It may have lost Apple up to like $16 million, but they've made that back maybe in rentals by now. And it's not easy to judge a film that goes on a streaming platform as well as in the cinema just by box office, right? Because they're looking to drive subscriptions as well as get it rented out and also bolster the prestige nature of their streaming platform as well. So there's a lot of different factors. But as far as the response, the film has 58% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ooh.
Yeah, the consensus as it's written is, I really like the first sentence here. Ridley Scott is intent on proving the Emperor has no clothes in Napoleon. There's praise for the battle scenes and the scale, but some people take issue with the length of it, the bloated direction. And if you really want to laugh, though, you need to read the French reviews, right? I got great quotes in there. Lazy, pointless, boring, migraine-inducing, too short, and historically inaccurate. That's just from one review. Someone else calling it deeply clumsy, unnatural, and unintentionally funny, and a leading historian in Napoleonic studies saying very anti-French and very pro-British.
Yeah, I
don't agree that it's pro-British.
I don't think it's anti... I don't think it's anti-French, but it doesn't show any nuance. He is obviously viewed very... Napoleon, like, it's their history, so he's viewed extremely differently than the Corsican ogre that, like, British propagandists portrayed him as. So, like, I don't think... Well, I wouldn't say it's anti-French. I would say it doesn't show... the man and his achievements in whole, anyway.
Maybe pro-British in the sense that it portrays Napoleon a certain way and they regard that as British? Is that what they mean?
I would assume so because it's kind of playing into the propaganda about Napoleon in England that has less to do with, you know, the factors of his character that we're going to talk about.
That's fair.
Although Scott said, responding to the French critics, the French don't even like themselves.
Which is probably also fair.
So
I would agree that it was unintentionally funny.
Kind of a sweeping statement to make, I'd say, by Ridley, but okay.
Wouldn't be like
characteristic of Ridley Scott, I would suggest.
But as you said, there's a lot of missing context when you're watching this film, right? Like, we don't really know why Egypt's invaded. We don't know why there's a coup happening. We don't know why he wishes to subdue and conquer Europe.
No.
We don't know why anything. This whole film is just, there's no purpose to any action. It's crazy.
The only angle.
It's like scenes from a really long, like seasons long television show have just been selected ad hoc and slapped together into a movie. It doesn't make any sense. The film.
But that's why we're here to provide that context to you today. Now, I do want to mention before we get into like the timeline of Napoleon's life, which is how we're going to try to structure this. I think the biggest inaccuracy that you mentioned, Michael, is basically Napoleon's character. And we just mentioned the kind of leaning into pro-British propaganda, perhaps, aspect of it. So Napoleon's character, as he is in the film, we need to talk about the ages.
I think the age is probably the one to kind of hone in on first. And like, don't get me wrong, when I heard Joaquin Phoenix was going to be Napoleon, I thought... That's not a bad casting for a middle-aged, say, Waterloo-era
Napoleon.
Yeah. Because, you know, he's similar enough age. You would have seen warts and all Napoleon. Mm-hmm. But the problem with this is you're seeing Napoleon from a young age. Like, for context, that he was like 19 when the revolution took place.
Yeah.
He was made a general at 24. You would expect to see the evolution from, like, say... this young hero, you know, encapsulating the romance of the era, you know, this great conquering hero, this young hope, you know, who believed in the values of the Enlightenment and all this thing. You would expect to see a progression from his young life in the 1790s up until 1815, where he's worn out. He's suffering from hemorrhoids. He can't ride his horse properly. He's tired, grumpy, and really regretful.
But you don't see any of that. He's that guy from the start.
That's the problem. And that's, I suppose, that's it just discredits the film a little bit throughout. You don't see an evolution.
Yeah, he's formed as is from the start. The other thing, I don't know what you guys thought about, but I thought Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby had no chemistry at all. Like, I didn't think they, you know, I'm not trying to ascribe that blame to either one of them, but I don't think they worked at all. Like, and maybe it's because he's so visibly so much older than she is, or certain, I don't know what her age is, but he looks a lot older than her.
Well, in reality, in the real romance in, like, Josephine was 6 years older than him, so she was the senior partner in the relationship.
And And even if you didn't know that, though, I mean, they just don't. There's points at which I'm just like, is he your dad? Like, you know, there's some points where, you know, I'm like, I don't know how old she is, but I would guess like early 30s.
She's now 35, would have been.
Okay, so early 30s. She would have been, what, 33, 34?
Wait, sorry. Yes. Sorry, I had it confused because Jodie Comer, who was in The Last Duel, was originally supposed to be Josephine. Now she's even younger. She's 30 now. But anyway,
that's ridiculous.
Kirby's 35. Joaquin Phoenix is now 49 years old.
I don't know what you guys thought, but I thought they had no chemistry. It didn't work at all.
Yeah.
And she's portrayed as being quite vulgar. Real, like, there's no evidence that she was.
She wasn't like, there's no evidence she was like that at all.
So,
yeah.
Like, I think they took a lot of liberties. Also, there's other casting problems too. Like, you see Robespierre, he's only in it briefly at the beginning of the film. He's the great hero of, well, I wouldn't say hero, but he was for a while the shining light of the revolution. Yeah. So he was sort of the extreme Jacobin who instigated the terror in France during the
What's wrong with his casting?
Well, he looks more like he was this very upright figure who believed in the, you know, living cleanly and the supremacy the supremacy of the enlightened man. Like, he had this sort of, you know, very high opinion of himself, to say the least. A massive ego, as all these characters do. But in the film, he's portrayed more as, say, Danton, who was another important figure from the revolution. He actually looks more like Danton.
It's like to combine the two people, isn't it?
You get a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of that going on, but I think the background cast just goes so far into the background that I couldn't even tell you who's who out of the two people that you just make, like, in the film.
They make,
you know,
no effort to be like, this is Maximilian Robespierre, even though, like, people who study history in Europe and in the States and stuff, like, they that's a name they'd know.
Yeah, but I think a bigger problem to me, well, there's the chemistry with between the two main actors, right?
I don't know if you guys felt that. I felt that.
That is true, I think, but more so to me, I was like, he just doesn't have chemistry with anyone. And, like, I don't know much about Napoleon, but to me, I'm like, I don't believe this because I know that he was loved by the people and
inspired. Charismatic.
Like, they show him, like, patting the odd, you know, soldier on the back, but I'm like, I know this, like, he's supposed to be this great military man and also this great man of the people, like a populist in a sense, and like gets the whole country riled up and gets them to make him the emperor, but like he's just has this stone face throughout.
It's a concrete block.
He's supposed to be really extroverted and charismatic when he needs to be, but we don't see that.
There's a reason people refer to him as the Caesar of the age, because he's a similar kind of character. People love them.
Yeah,
like, and Joaquin Phoenix is just this, plays this gruff, dour, sad old man.
Yeah,
that's who he bears me, and I'm like, that's not Napoleon at all.
It's a gross mischaracterization. Like the real Napoleon, he was very charismatic. He was warm. He loved to like joke and tease people. Whether that was one of his soldiers on campaign, like sometimes a soldier would let a shout at him, like going, we need new shoes or, you know, food, and you know what I mean? And he'd be like, march quicker, you'll get them. You know, this type of thing. He was well able to kind of, you know, have the bants, you know what I mean? With anybody, really. So, like,
which is how people in historical movies, that's how they love depicting kings and things, like, down there digging in the trenches. Like, at least...
weren't really like that.
He actually was like that. Throw that in there. I don't know.
For me, that's like it's like I was saying at the start. It's unforgivable. Like this guy is, he's like Caesar, Mao, Jesus, Muhammad. He's that level important. I mean, laugh, but he is that level of important. If you know, he's
the dream team.
He's that kind of figure.
The super friends.
The dream team with Mao. But you know what I mean. He's that kind of level of consequential. Like, you know, and it's just this miserable.
Well, it's a bit. They play him as a spoiled child.
You
know, he's like, really
such
petulant.
A strange thing to do.
Like, there's a couple of quotes in the film. One of them, like, this is when Napoleon is like the consul of France, so of a high position, like basically a dictator of France. And like, he lets a shout at the English ambassador, you know, you think you're so great because you have boats.
That was hilarious. That line
it is in the
so
film,
funny.
But it's completely like he'd never say something like that. And the French army had quite a decent navy until Trafalgar.
And also, just to really hammer the point home, like, there's a very good argument to say he's the greatest general of all time. He doesn't say something like, you think you're great because you have boats.
And I think it's fine to make that change, right? But as you said, if you're making that change have it be the a different caricature, like have it be the weird propaganda version, yeah. Do a Woody Allen type yeah. romantic comedy.
Do a Death of Stalin version of it, yeah, like do a joke out of it.
That's yeah. a Death of Stalin line. Yeah. That's not what you expect 100%. To see in this. And in Death of Stalin, we excuse that because it presents itself as inaccurate. Yeah. Whereas
like the
here,
way they portray Zhukov in Death of Stalin. You yes. know? I fucked Germany. I think I can handle it. You know, that kind of thing. That's a funny line. And the way he delivers it as well is even comedic. I thought anyway. It's like deadpan comedic.
Yeah, it's the film is intent on making fun of Napoleon. Really,
yeah, really seems that way. So maybe that must be what the French I think mean. That's but it. Yeah, okay. Fair
and
enough,
you
then,
see
yeah.
the and but there's also a thing that annoyed me is that like you see they make him out to be kind of personally cruel to Josephine
yeah, they do,
and
yeah.
like obviously they had
very much so
they had terrible scene. Rows. But there is one scene in the film where they're having dinner and you know he's amongst his family with Josephine and it's later on and they're
including
they're,
his mother's there.
Yeah, they're trying to find an heir and like he publicly. Like shouts at her
starts
like, in
a
violent
fight.
Way, you know. Yeah.
She throws food on him. He throws food back at her. You know?
Yeah, and he says something that's so like he was a very cultivated man. You know, he understood. He loved the sciences. You know, he loved. You know, he would have had an understanding of anatomy, all these things. And yet, and in the film, he's like he shouts across at her like, "You will make. You will give me an heir tonight. You will get pregnant tonight, or I will divorce you." Yeah. Like it comes makes him out to be a brute.
Yep.
And he wouldn't have done that. Like he loved Josephine as we'll find out, you know. Yeah. So I think that one of the big things is it's just his character is like in the, if you were to just know look at this film, you would come across as having a very poor opinion of Napoleon as basically a spoiled child.
It is know? A character assassination,
which as I was saying, I think it's fine to make that change, but the film. Decides that is the whole film. Like, that's yeah, yeah. all that the yeah, film yeah. wants to do, which, again, is also a fine choice, but making that change as well and not really delivering on the chemistry and things, like, it all adds up into an underwhelming film, which is so unfortunate. Because, like, on our Patreon, we have the Napoleon Hype Train episode. If you want to go to patreon.com/realhistorypodcast, hear us all excited about the trailer and the battles. There are good parts, right? Like, the battles, etc. Yeah. But, like...
I was so looking forward to it. Like, and when I saw that he had cast Joaquin Phoenix, I actually thought maybe this was silly of me, but I thought it was going to be the 100 days.
Just the 100
days.
The
I thought it would
life.
Just be that. And I thought, and that's like in hindsight, I feel like that's really what they should have done.
Yeah. Well, much like the film, we're going to now rewind to basically baby Napoleon. He's going to, please imagine him as an aged man throughout this, but we're going to go back to the start of his start of his life and start of his career, where he came from, which is the focus of this first of our trilogy of Napoleon episodes. So Napoleon, his start, where did he come from?
Well, Napoleone de Bonaparte.
As he was born.
He was born in 1769. So if you think about that, that's 20 years exactly before the French Revolution.
Takes off, yeah.
And he was born into like a place that I suppose hasn't had a major influence on European history. And I'm saying that as an Irish person as well, from a small island too. But it's the island of Corsica, a small island in the Mediterranean, which...
That's good to know because I've heard the term like, oh, he's just a Corsican, but I have never Googled it. I didn't know it was an island, so yeah, this is good to know.
Yeah, it's just north of Sardinia.
It's one of those curious things. You know, he's obviously so associated with France, but he's not French.
Yeah, and this is the thing. So, like, he was born onto this island itself. Like, the island itself had been for centuries under the control of Genoa, so a northern Italian state.
Yeah.
And it was only in 1768 that it had been, basically the island itself had been transferred to Ancien Régime France. So the Bourbon monarchy controlled it. And this put Napoleon's family in a bit of an odd position because they were local noblesse, you know. They weren't by any chance, they weren't by any stretch extremely wealthy. Like, they always would have had olives, they always would have had wine because they would have had their own olive groves, their own vineyards, all that type of thing. Their family origins would have been back in Tuscany, and they had would have moved to Corsica separately.
Which explains essentially why his name is Italian and not French.
This is it, yeah.
And
this is why he wouldn't have spoken French. He didn't actually learn French until he was 10. And what always endeared me to this guy as somebody who has a very thick accent myself when I speak French is that even though he would eventually become emperor of the French, like he had a appalling accent all his life, and people would remark on it, you know. But in fairness, he only learned it when he was 10, so we're not going to be too hard
and
on
famously French, you know. If you're not born into it, it is hard to you can't sound like a natural.
Oh yeah, very well. If you're me, anyway. But anyway, he was born into Ajaccio, which is sort of like one of the main towns of Corsica. His parents would have been Letitia, so his mother, and Carlo Bonaparte, and they had 13 kids. Now, 8 of them would only have survived. So Napoleon had a big family, and I suppose one thing to be aware of when you're talking about Napoleon is he spent a lot of his time and energy just being the pater familiar, you know, the head of the family, you know, the head of the family. And he worried throughout his life about his brothers, his sisters, making sure that they were married to the right people.
There's none of that in the movie. For,
yeah, and like
it's not shown at all.
One of his brothers is in there.
Yeah.
There's a couple, yeah. Like we'll go into the brothers. Some of them, some of them caused him headaches. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. But I suppose what's very interesting about him is that Carlo, his father, would have been a secretary to a famous Corsican nationalist. So a man called Paoli, who wanted basically Corsica to be independent. He didn't want the French there at all.
Yeah.
And so his father would have originally been his secretary, and what essentially he did was he betrayed that cause, and he decided that the rising star was France. So when France took over the island of Corsica in his youth, his father Carlo, he went to the court in Paris, and he met with Louis the king, and you know, he petitioned for his nobility to be recognized.
Yeah.
And this was really important because the family were quite impoverished. So the only way that Napoleon or any of his siblings could hope to get an education would be if the French ancien regime recognized his family as being noble and give him basically a grant to go to school. And because France at the time was keen for its new possession, Corsica, to be fully integrated into the country.
Be francophied.
Yeah, it had basically a fund for children of poor nobles.
To be francification of the nobles, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He eventually in the 1770s, he got recognition of his nobility. He had to, I'd say, do up a dodgy family tree. And he disallowed Napoleon to go to France at the age of 10. And it sounds unusual now, but like he would have seen his family. Like imagine a 10-year-old being sent to this, for all intents and purposes, a fully foreign country at 10 years old. Doesn't speak the language. Has a really thick accent even when he does eventually learn the language. And what I suppose is really important to recognize about his future character is that he's immediately into essentially military-like schools.
Yeah.
So they're teaching, these schools are designed, he went to one in Brienne in northern France, they're designed to create the next generation of army officers. Of soldiers. So they would have been highly regimental.
Not unusual for the sons of nobles. It's the kind of education.
It was what was expected of him.
Yeah.
But because of this, his father back in Corsica was seen as a bit of a traitor. And Napoleon
he was in a French one and he was a nationalist.
Yeah, exactly. And so he would have been seen as a bit of a traitor. And what's unusual about Napoleon is all throughout his school years in France, he was a Corsican nationalist. He hated France. He didn't. Yeah. He said, like, there's a quote that, oh, ever since France vomited its army upon our beautiful island, you know, it had, you know, so he was bitter about it. He had a real chip on his shoulders and all of his early writings because he wrote, you know.
Would you say he had a sort of complex about it?
He definitely had a complex about that and a chip on his shoulder. But then later on in his life, I suppose, after his initial education in Brienne, he went on to one of the most prestigious, the École Militaire in Paris, where he was basically, it was the elite school.
Is this when you're like a more older teenager type age?
Yes, again. Yeah. So he would have been, this would have been in 1779 up till about 1784. He would have been continuing his education.
And is it very
steeped in the classics, a lot of it as well, yeah, which is really important to understand his mindset.
And is it very military focused? I was going to ask, but you just said, you know, you're learning the classics as you were doing at the times. You know, this is the same sort of time period when we're talking about the American Revolution and what sort
same,
of what education did people get around that time? Of course, you're reading a lot of like
it's Cicero, all Greece,
a lot of Cicero,
Rome.
Caesar, you're reading
yeah, Alexander, yeah. And this stuff captured his imagination,
yeah,
you know, and he was obsessed, like Caesar was his hero. He would later dream of being like Alexander as well, and part of his Egyptian campaign, he dreamed of eventually reaching India, you know, as Alexander had done. Turned out it was entirely unrealistic, but he could dream all he liked, you know.
Unrealistic enough for Alexander as well.
Yeah. Yeah, watch the movie. Come on, Napoleon.
Yeah. So yeah, he was steeped in the classics, and his education apart from that would have been a lot of mathematics, a lot of the sciences, and in general he was a Renaissance man. Like yeah. One of the most important things to read him think to realize about him is that he even at a young age he would go without food to buy books, you know. So even when he was on a small salary, he'd be sending money back to his family in Corsica, because obviously he had 8 siblings as well to look after. His father died at the age of 38 from cancer. So, you know, that's extremely young, obviously. And then him and his older brothers had to essentially take over the running of the family. We won't go labor the point, but his father had left him in severe financial difficulties.
A
lot of the early revolutionary period where you're thinking, oh, Napoleon must be in the middle of all this stuff that's happening in Paris, you know, the terror, all that. A lot of time he was back home trying to sort out the finances,
yeah,
you know, of his family, trying to get them out of debt, which I suppose is something you don't really realize, you know. I suppose his early years, he went from being a Corsican nationalist, very insular, to suddenly realizing that when the French Revolution happened, he was fully supportive of it. And he realized, and he's...
Makes sense, I guess, if you're like, fuck France, or yeah, fuck France in its current state, right?
Yeah, well, he saw France as being the most progressive, or revolutionary France, as being the most progressive shining light on the continent. You know,
he wasn't alone.
It was the
that.
Vehicle.
A lot yeah. of people thought that.
Yeah, you know, it was the vehicle. If you believed
in
progress,
country,
yeah.
that,
equality yeah. before the law, religious yeah. tolerance, all yeah. of these things, and he saw France as being this the guiding light. So then he made a decision, I suppose, in his youth, that his future lied in France and not so much in Corsica.
Also, it's probably important to say that the overthrow of an old system is nothing if not a great provider of opportunity. Mm. So like a competent person can do well in chaos, you know?
Yeah, well, if he was so busy sending money home to France and not participating in the revolution, how was he at Marie Antoinette's execution, guys? I saw it in the film. It definitely happened, right?
Yeah, so this is just one of many inaccuracies, I suppose. The opening scene of the film, it's obviously visually spectacular. It's supposed to be in the midst of the terror. I think it's 1793.
Which the terror, like the revolution, the terror, we're going to probably save that for dedicated episodes, right? We can't talk about...
We can't really get too much into the revolution. We'll be here all day.
Yeah, so maybe a Marie Antoinette episode in our future after all.
There's a movie. She has her own movie. We'll do it.
Yeah, like I suppose it's just a striking scene. She's walking out towards the guillotine. She's striding up, you know, full of pride. She's got this big bushy blonde hair.
And they're throwing food at her and stuff, and she's like not reacting, you know.
Yeah, incidentally, if you were about to be guillotined, they would have cropped your hair.
You don't have big long hair, but it's not as evocative.
Which is why Josephine would have had that close cropped hair later on, right?
Prison haircut, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, but so either way, just to dispel that, he wasn't present in Paris in 1793 in the height of the terror. He was back in a lot of stuff in Corsica, like I said, trying to fix his family finances, but also he was like trying to, take over the National Guard in Corsica. He tried all these things that are later forgotten about. He wasn't very good at politics at a young age, like let's just put it that way.
He was more of a fighting man, really, or a military man, I should say.
Yeah, now, although he wasn't at Marie Antoinette's execution, he was in Paris the year before in 1792. So he did witness the storming of Le Palais des Tuileries, so like the one of the main palaces in Paris. If anyone's visited Paris, it's where the Louvre Museum is now. Mm. You know, it's this. So he was there and he did, like, he was shocked to his core to see the treatment of the king and his family. They were basically taken hostage.
They're just torn out
and forced to wear like a revolutionary cockade in their hair to say that they vive la revolution. You can imagine a French king having been forced to say that type of thing. So he did see some of the revolution, but he wasn't there in that particular time. No.
And what did he make of it, I guess?
Of the revolution.
Yeah.
He was excited by the fact that suddenly Europe, or France in particular, seemed to be catching up on the Enlightenment. All these ideas, like the Rousseauian ideas of, he famously said, what was it? Man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains. And he was delighted to see that France would all of a sudden, like this new Republican government was doing things like banning slavery, removing the church from someone having so much control over people's lives, removing the feudal privileges of the ancien regime, because France during before the revolution was the nobility and the clergy basically paid no tax. All the taxation and all the heavy lifting was being done by the third estate.
The people who can't afford it. Like.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was delighted to see that, but at the same time, he was a Jacobin in his old age, which was basically extreme left. He was a part of, he did support Robespierre's government, but he did famously say years later, when people criticized him about being so extreme left, he said, any man of spirit at that time would have been. That's the way he said it. Like, he was a young man at the end of the day, seeing all these. So he was excited by the revolution, and also, I suppose, the revolution opened up, as we said before,
opportunity.
Someone of his noblesse, his nobility, probably wouldn't have ever hoped, could never have hoped to have risen above, as an officer in the army, where suddenly the world opened up a whole new set of opportunities where he could become a general, a conqueror, and eventually an emperor.
Yeah, and like, I guess last we checked in on his progress, he was still in military academy, right? So where does he, what's the first step on to becoming that person who we know today? Like, where what opportunity does he seize? What happens?
What happens is, just briefly, the terror comes to an end in 1794. There's what's called the Terminator coup d'etat. And essentially Robespierre is taken down a peg or two, guillotined himself. The prisons are open up. Thousands of people are certainly
freed. We do see in the film, right? Like, this is...
Is
he in the military at this stage, or is he still like studying military?
Yeah, no, he would have been. I believe he was stationed in Valence in the south of France.
Yeah, that's right.
And suddenly a new government came to replace the terror, the government that had led to the terror, Robespierre's extreme government, I suppose, extreme left government, a directorate. So it's sort of like a small executive of five people took over France. And they were more centrist. They were less extreme, but they still believed in the revolutionary ideals.
They were still very much Republicans. They were still very much hated by the other powers of Europe, the royal houses of Europe, and France is still very much at war now with the monarchies in Europe. You know, they are now viewing France as the great enemy because it represents something that could happen to their own countries. I think France is an existential threat. Mm. That's how the great empires
Well, that's why the nobles are being housed in Britain or anywhere that'll keep them right.
Yeah, because you've heard the Scarlet Pimpernel. That's about trying to
from Blackadder, obviously.
Of course. Well, that's about trying to rescue French nobles as if they fucking didn't deserve what was coming to them, and a lot of them did, frankly.
There's chaos in France, we're saying. When the French Revolution happened, there was a series of coalitions all invading France. There was insurrections in the Vendée, in Western France. So the royalists, so basically there was a civil war between those who wanted the Republic mm-hmm. and those who wanted to reestablish the...
Which is so important to remember, because like in so many of these historical changes, it's easy, without looking into it, you're usually like, and then, like I said in like a previous episode, like, and then, you know, Russia became communist.
Yeah,
and it's like,
the Civil War.
There's a lot of different people with a lot of different opinions. And of course, a lot of folks would be royalists within France.
There's a big royalist element in France that's pushing against the revolutions, against the Republic.
Yeah, and these are being supported by Britain. And this is why at this time, when there is all this upheaval and civil war, in 1793, so you have the city of Toulon in southern France has suddenly been occupied by these royalists. So the French men and women who wanted to reestablish the monarchy, and they're being aided by?
They're being aided by the British and the Spanish to an extent as well. And what's really happened here is the Toulon is an important port. Like militarily, you've got an important port here, and this is being locked down by the British Navy. Yeah. Napoleon, this is the first point at which he takes a command of note, a command that you could ascribe fame to. And essentially, what he does is he comes up with a way of relieving the blockade, first of all, but also making the royalist position in Toulon untenable. And the way he does that is there's a fort, essentially on a hill overlooking the port. The French Republic, the Republican forces, fears they'd have to do a direct assault against the city, and that, you know, assaulting a city is a nightmare in any historical period. Like, a city siege is a disaster. You don't have to do that. If you can avoid it, avoid it. Napoleon comes up with a way to avoid it. And his plan is an audacious night attack on the fort. So his plan is they'll overwhelm the defenders of the fort, and you might think, okay, that's fine, but you don't have the city. But what you do have is you have the height. So it's similar to Washington's idea about how he liberated Boston. You take the hill that sort of overlooks the bay, and what he does is he essentially brings cannons to the fort, and they now have a direct fire line on the enemy ships that are sitting in the bay. This is the British fleet. Yeah. So Napoleon leads a night attack against the fort, and when I say leads it, like, he's in the fighting, he's right in front of it. It's none of this kind of, you know, charge boys.
This is his personal bravery.
Yeah, it's personal bravery. He doesn't shout charge, he shouts follow me boys. He's that kind of a leader. So he's in the front. This is a dashing, daring, incredible attack. A night attack is difficult to do. Attacking a fort is also difficult to do, but he sort of catches them a bit. It's so daring that they don't expect it. They overwhelm the defending forces, and they bring the cannons in. He then opens up the cannon fire against the British fleet, and it forces them to withdraw from the port lest they lose their ships. That's what opens Toulon again. The Royalist forces feel their position is now untenable. There are French ships there. They can open fire into the city on the Royalist forces. So the Royalist forces have to withdraw. So he retakes Toulon with a small force, completely against the odds, where it was thought we'll have to do this massacre attack against the city. And he really does it without losing too many men. He does get wounded in this battle. I think he gets stabbed in the leg in this battle climbing over a wall.
And his horse, as you see in the film, his horse does get shot. Now, I don't know if you've seen the film, him taking the cannonball out of the horse. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. But like, I'm not sure if he did that.
Probably didn't do that, to be fair. In the chaos of a battle. I don't know,
but it was an early sign of his military brilliance. And one thing I think is important to realize about him as well is he had just a great understanding of military, the psychology of a soldier. Yep. And there's a great anecdote from the Battle of Toulon where basically when he was carrying out this assault, Mark, there was one of the forts called Fort Musgrave, mm-hmm. and there was a battery of guns, and everyone kept who was manning the battery of guns for France or the French forces were being either wounded or shot, and you know it was kind of getting hard to find any volunteers. You know, so he named the actual battery of guns L'Homme Sans Peur, so the men without fear. And because he knew then that
it would get in the head of the soldier.
Like, yeah. And then suddenly it was just constant volunteers going up there. So it was an early indication that he had a deep understanding of what motivated soldiers.
Yeah.
And that would stand to him his whole life.
Mm. Yeah, which I guess like understanding military tactics and how to move blocks sort of around a battlefield is one thing. And then understanding how how the individuals think and how the group thinks and how that can be worked is like part of his genius, right?
Yeah, and I suppose what, just getting back to what Mark said as well about Toulon and all of his battles, and you don't see this in the film at all, the amount of preparation the man put into, like he would study, that he had a great interest in geography, topography.
Terrain, really know the land,
And maths as well, because he was an artillery officer originally, like he understood the importance of accuracy of mathematics.
Geometry.
Yeah. So he was able to kind of, he understood every single piece of an artillery range. So if, say for example, they ran out of a certain type of ammunition, he knew how to make that ammunition from things that were just lying around. Do you know what I mean? He knew the ins and outs of his trade.
He'd know how to fix it. And he'd talk to the officers. Yeah. Oh yeah, don't we need to do this? There was nothing beneath him. Nothing's beneath him, yeah.
And that endeared him to his soldiers as well. Like Mark said, he would always be very happy to put his shoulder to the...
It's Marius's mules. He's in the trenches with them digging the latrines. Yeah. He's like, you know, helping. He sits with them. He eats what they eat. That kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not well expressed in the film, but this battle, as we mentioned, it is in the film. It's filmed in Malta, and he does do a bunch of like. Basically, the first half of the film is like a lot of him going around looking at stuff. Joaquin Phoenix is just kind of block face looking at things. But he like rides around this town and he's looking at things. And I guess that's encompassing the studying that you were mentioning. They do the night assault, and I to be fair, I did what you described, Mark. It's pretty well in tune with what I see in the film.
And even the lead up to it where he describes, he's like, you don't need to take the town.
Yeah.
You're like, what? We need to take... He's like, no. You make the town untenable. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even that concept, understanding that means that you know a strategy.
You knew it couldn't be reinforced if the ships weren't there. Yeah. So that they would have to give up, you know?
So this was his first like very impressive feat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People were astonished he achieved it that quickly as well. They just didn't think that could really be done like that.
And what did that lead to?
Well, it led to fame among the right set of people would be a better way to put that.
The directorate.
I was going to ask because they're kind of running things right now. There's five of them. There's some politics about the directorate in the film, but maybe who are these people? What are they? What is the practicality of running the country at this stage?
Well, I suppose they're trying to, you know, fight off France's enemies, but they're also extremely corrupt.
Extremely individuals.
Yeah. They saw Napoleon, there would be constant infighting amongst the directorate. You had people like Duco and CA and Barras, and you know they were all trying to get one over on each other.
And they will have viewed Barras in particular will have viewed Napoleon as a weapon, to use for their own devices, or initially at least for their own devices.
And that's why he promoted him so much. Right. And that's why after Toulon, he made sure to kind of put his arm around Napoleon, this young general.
Mm.
The other thing I'd say is, what's important to realize is that none of this would have happened if Napoleon at the time hadn't been considered to be credible in their eyes as a Republican. He was considered be a pure Republican that was ready to die for the cause.
Mm.
Obviously, later in life, we'll see that, you know, he changes quite a lot, say the least. But because of this, they suddenly gave this young man a lot of responsibility. And now there was a lot of people at the time, young French military officers, who suddenly were able to advance quickly because, first of all, half the army had been royalist, so they had been left. They'd either gone into exile.
Especially the experienced. A lot of the experienced officers were royalists, weren't they? Because they were nobles who had been through the academies, the military academies, but of course sided with the king rather than sided with the people.
Yeah, and even the ones appointed by Robespierre, during his reign, they were dismissed every time they made a loss. They would dismiss another one, like and they'd be locked up, guillotined. It was a mess, you know. Yeah. So there was these. It wasn't unusual for a man of 20. It was unusual for a man of 24 to be given so much power. Barras pushed him then to be, I think, in control of the Army of the Interior.
Yeah.
And then later, basically the defense of the of Paris.
Yeah, so in 1795, there is a royalist, essentially a royalist uprising in Paris that tries to push against the Directory. Is it the Directory or the Directorate?
Directorate, yeah. Directorate. But you can say both.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a royalist uprising against the Directorate. Napoleon is pushed into the defense of the Directorate in Paris itself. Now, this is shown in the film, but not really given the sort of the level of gore. I know there is a brutal shot where people are hit with cannons and stuff, but just to put this in a sort of a better context, the royalist force is about 25,000 into the streets of Paris, the narrow streets of Paris,
which this is before the broad boulevards,
yeah,
right?
This is before Napoleon got his arc,
because you don't necessarily think of narrow streets.
It's before
streets,
Napoleon rebuilds Paris into the way that you think of Paris now. So the streets are much, much more narrow, and it's 25,000, a massive mob of royalists. And Napoleon basically has 24 hours to organize the defense of the Directorate, the defense of Paris. So he develops a system of choke points where he focuses artillery. So if you think about artillery cannons, which are designed to be used on an open battlefield, are being positioned into these narrow streets that thousands and thousands of royalists are going to run down. So he creates kill zones. And it's brutal. It's an absolute massacre. These royalists will be sort of forced by some cannon fire into a certain area where then batteries of cannons will open on them. And this is particularly brutal, because first of all, he organizes plans and executes this within 24 hours, but in the fight he only loses 100 men against 25,000,
and he's ruthless,
and those are credible numbers. Like, that's not like a gross exaggeration. It could be wrong here and there by a few, whatever, but it's not a gross exaggeration to say, like, losing 100 men in any context against 25,000 is insane.
He's basically saving the Directorate, because traditionally
they owe their existence to him.
If that level of people in the past, in just the previous 5 to 10 years, had have taken over Paris, the government nearly would have fallen. But Napoleon wasn't afraid to be ruthless. And we see this throughout his career. And this is where the famous whip of grapeshot quote comes from. That basically the grapeshot was a form of stuff that, you know, it was from cannon fire. You know, it was a form of, it would indiscriminately hurt people.
It's like shotgun pellets.
Yeah, smaller.
On a huge scale, so like really broad, and just hit everyone. Like, you know,
cannons are designed to destroy things, whereas grapeshot is designed to kill people.
Yes,
but traditionally you wouldn't fire a cannon on your own people, and this meant
in the middle of the
street,
like, it was crazy.
This showed that the Directorate and Napoleon meant business. Mm-hmm. He famously said, "To cannon, all men are equal." Yeah. You know?
Well, that's very one of his Republican many ideal.
I would just point as well, this is another example of when there was hand-to-hand street fight, he's in the front line of the fight again. He's actually in it. Like. Mm. So he does actually fight hand-to-hand in this battle.
Do we know how many of the 25,000 died? Because it seems in the film and from your description, people are massacred, right?
I don't know offhand the exact numbers, the casualty numbers, but they melt away because they're brutalized. I think it'd be difficult to even picture the level of gore. Like, these narrow streets of cannons just grape-shotting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people per volley. Like, just brutal, brutal. So he is showing himself here to the Directorate to be a hardcore, diehard loyalist to them. That's what they would think here that he's doing.
Yes.
He's a real, real hardcore Republican, this guy, to the extent that he will do horrible things in the name of the revolution. Or that's what they think, at least. And he is seeing this as... Or he is, to the soldiers at least, has shown himself to be an incredible commander who also throws himself into the fight again for the second time.
Yeah.
So things have gone pretty well for him here. Overnight nearly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and as a short note, this would be the same year that he meets Josephine, who obviously is one of the main characters of the film, but we're going to save discussions of Josephine and Napoleon's relationship for future episodes, because we're doing this in three parts. We're trying to fit everything in here. But this would be around the time when they met.
Yeah, and you actually see this in the film very briefly. There's a comedy after the fall of the Robespierre government. You see them all enjoying sort of a theater. It's supposed to show that basically normal life has resumed, the theatres are open again, there's a you can do, like hedonistic pleasures are allowed again.
Yeah.
So you see Napoleon actually sitting beside Barras, so one of the leading members of the government, the directorate. And this is true. She was, like, Josephine was Barras's lover,
yeah,
you know? And what the rumor is that Barras thought, okay, to tie Napoleon, this young kid, he needs a bit of direction. To tie Napoleon closer to me, I'll introduce him to Josephine. And there's also rumor that he had got sick of Josephine and she loved spending money and that he couldn't afford her. It was just basically a way of kind of like, you know, kind of saying, well, look at this guy. He's a rising star, you know.
It's manipulative from Barras though, because he knows Napoleon and he knows her and he thinks... And he like won't be able to resist her.
And he's right.
And he was right, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's like, we've obviously gone through a lot there very, very quickly, but it's safe to say that he has had a miraculous almost rise.
Yeah.
Coming from this small island, and then suddenly he's at the center of politics in Paris, and now he's on to his first great campaign, really.
Yeah, following this sort of position, he's given an unenviable job, a job that many officers would have turned down, frankly, because it was an opportunity for failure. Like, an opportunity for grave failure, really. So he's given control of the army of Northern Italy. Now, just to stress, that doesn't mean an Italian army. He's given command of the French forces that are in Northern Italy. Why are the French forces in Northern Italy? There's a massive war going on with all of the other European powers who are existentially threatened by the French Revolution. Now, Italy is not a country at this point. So forget your ideas of what Italy is, as I'm always saying in history. It just does, you know. We're 50 years before Italy unifies. So Garibaldi hasn't even been born.
What are they, city-states? What's going on?
There's city-states. There's some of it is controlled by the Austrian Empire. The Pope controls.
Papal really, states.
You know, like the Vatican that we think of now as a little part of a city. He had a huge truck of land right in the middle of Italy. There are city-states that have 500 years of history. There are city-states that have 25 minutes of history. You know what I mean? It's a patchwork of different polities. Into that, the French army is facing off against the Austrian army, and there are Italian troops sort of on both sides. Some cities are with you, some cities are against you, all those kinds of things. Now, it's not going that well, frankly.
It's a ragtag army. It's underfunded.
They tell him, they said, oh yeah, Napoleon, the army of Northern Italy, yeah, there's 63,000 men there. There fucking is there, fuck, 63,000. That might be the actual number. How many can actually fight? More like 35 to 40. The other members of the army, they're suffering with disease. They're malnutritioned. There's elements of dysentery. This is attacking the officer corps, the artillery, the cavalry. Every element of this army is in bad shape.
Even just down to shoes, like they didn't have proper shoes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Or they weren't even wearing proper uniforms.
Yep.
So you know, they couldn't identify each other. It had been the It wasn't considered the most important front. That was considered the armies on the Rhine, yep. So facing the Holy Roman Empire at the time. So because of that, it was always last in the queue to get anything new.
And it's really like he's just being given the short stick, you know, but he turns that short stick into something very pointy, and he repeatedly stabs the Austrians with it.
Yeah, because it's also a little bit like, you've just done this great thing, shutting down the royalists. We know you mean business. Let's see what you can do with this mess.
With this absolute mess. Yeah, exactly. So what he does is within 2 weeks, so this is extraordinarily quick. Now, remember, you don't have radio communications here. So how he does this so fast is beyond me. Within 2 weeks, he reorganizes that army completely, and he moves the healthy troops essentially away from those that are suffering. He consolidates the resources and then reallocates it in a more sensible way, so that the army is completely reorganized into a smaller but much more mobile fighting force. And what ends up happening is, through really rapid movement throughout Northern Italy, he encounters the Austrian army several times. Now, the Austrian army is much bigger. It's a bigger force, but it's a bit more traditional. It doesn't move with the same kind of aggression Napoleon is single-minded here. He thinks, like, these guys are just kind of faffing about in northern Italy. They're not really, no one's really sure what the plan is, but his plan is, I'm going to just consistently outmaneuver them and just start smashing
into
them.
Speed and surprise.
Speed
and
surprise.
That was his main characteristic. Absolutely. As a young general anyway, you know, everything was about speed, surprise, force marches to jump up on top of people unexpected.
Yeah. He surprises the Austrian army at the Battle of Montenotte. Now, again, just I'm just going to give you a couple of numbers, and people... this is, again, it's credible.
This is not
numbers.
Like Roman Empire type
numbers.
No,
these are reasonably credible numbers. The Austrian losses are thousands, like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. The French army loses about 200 men. It's
and is this one battle? Or
this
more?
Is one battle. This is a battle of Montenotte. And the Austrian army is so shocked and brutalized quickly by this that they basically melt away. Like they start to pull back. But Napoleon goes on a rampage across northern Italy at this point. He's smashing into Austrian-held positions. Some towns just surrender as soon as they see him coming. It's just a lightning march across
He was so pleased with himself because he loved the classics, and he had obviously studied Caesar's campaigns in the Alps and all that years ago. So he was delighted. He would be like writing in his diary, you know, I managed to reach this area twice as fast as Caesar's legions, because it was the same area they were fighting in. You know, so he was so proud. And the thing, I suppose, is he was going up against Habsburg Austrian generals who were like in their 70s. They weren't exactly willing to try new tactics, and here's this new kid on the block that isn't afraid to try anything. Whatever.
In Napoleon's eyes, these officers were men who were playing at war.
Yeah,
that's what they were. They were all about, look at the glamour of it, and I'm going to go out and wear my ridiculous uniform. Napoleon didn't give a shit about any of that. Napoleon's like, ultra efficiency, speed at movement, and they just don't see this guy coming at all. This is just, it's a style of warfare. It's a determination of warfare that he hadn't encountered from a French army in Italy. And he just beats them. And he claims northern Italy for a revolution.
Which, these are things that, you know, it sounds weird to say, but anyone could have done, in quotes. Because he doesn't have guns and the other side doesn't have guns, right? Like, and he's learned this through studying military history. Obviously, not anyone could have done it. Like, he's like a brilliant military mind, and like the effects of this has reverberated through history, et cetera, et cetera. But it is interesting to think that he's just like applying what he's learned. He's doing a lot of thinking about how to go into battle, and that's what's paying off here.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on, Mark.
I was just going to say, like, people who play, like, tabletop RPGs or RPGs or whatever, you're familiar with the term initiative. That's what war is all about. Yeah. Like, that's what the great field armies are all about. Like, is who has the initiative? Like, and that's what he brings to the army, principally. That's the main thing he brings. Whatever about the organization, he brings real purpose to the army that's there. Because they've just been sitting there for years. You know, and it swings back and forth. The Austrians are sort of on top, and then the French might win a skirmish, whatever. This guy comes in and he just energizes, he electrifies it. And the Austrians just don't know how to cope with him.
See, like getting back to psychology, exactly. It's like he understood esprit de corps.
Yes.
Like he understood the importance of having a motivated...
This is where the phrase comes from. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. And it basically to keep everyone motivated. Like when he took over the army of Italy, he was like, okay, I know you're being ignored, your uniforms aren't there, you're cold, you're hungry, you haven't been paid in months. He's like, but guess what? Over there in Lombardy is some of the most fertile, rich land in the world. And he was like, there's your prize.
Yeah.
And like he famously said, you know, the soldier demands glory, distinction and reward. And that's what you will find in northern Italy. So this led to these three battles that Mark was saying. So in 1796, in quick succession and into 1797. So you had Lodi, Arcole, Rivoli, all these places. If you visit France today, there's streets named
streets
after
named
all
the
these
battles,
places
yeah.
still and train stations and all this. Because this cemented his reputation.
Yeah. As well, it should be understood, the conventional wisdom at the time is that the Austrian Habsburg army is not an army you dick it with. They this is an army that's feared. This is a 19th century level of maybe it's overly romanticized or maybe even at the time it was overly romanticized. But it is astonishing that they just keep losing. And they just don't see it coming, and they can't understand why they keep losing. They're like, but we're doing everything right. But this guy is just bringing a level that you just don't, you just don't know how to cope with. You just haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
It moves too quick.
And what were you were saying, Michael, his ability to inspire people. Like, it's all well and good if you can think about these things, write them down. Like, this is the optimal way to take this.
Yeah, doing it is different.
Doing it is different and getting people, inspiring people, yes, and pulling them along with you. That's what's so lacking in the film from old Stoneface Phoenix. Like, he does not, we see
him. He has no charisma in the film.
He's patting soldiers on the back. And at the end, you know, skipping ahead, spoiler alert, but when he comes back and he's like, yes, shoot me if you want or join me, it's still like, I can't, I didn't see in the film why they wouldn't shoot him, you know, but this is the thing, right? Like, and why the army becomes his
army. Yeah. Like, when he's leading this whole thing where he's patting him on the shoulder, he learns their names. Like, he learns soldiers' names. This is a great trick. Mm. Great generals always do this. I don't mean officers. I mean, like, he'll ask an officer, what's that guy's name? And then just engineer a situation where he's just walking past him and he'd call his name out and say, you fought really well at, you know, that kind of thing. That's a thing that general, great general, he's good at that.
And he'd never forget a favor. So, like, years later, for example, he would always, like, if he remembered that someone had done him a great turn when in his youth, he would send him like a massive bag of money when he was the emperor, Like, there was a cafe owner, I think, when he was in Italy and he didn't have a lot of money. And, like, he made sure years later that this lady used to give him free coffee or something. Years later, he sent her a massive bag of money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Randomly. He was like, send her this. You know what I mean? Yeah. So he did have this. Yeah, he had this. He. I suppose, like you said, Mark, he knew names. He'd remember things, and he'd always have an anecdote. He'd always have a little moment to share with his, what were called his grognards. So these were like his veteran grumpy soldiers that stayed with him throughout all his campaigns.
Like, he loved them. Guys, yeah.
And so we get to a peace treaty in Italy.
Yeah, which he, I mean, he forces a peace treaty on them. That is the way to phrase it. Which ends, you know, this phase of the Republican Wars or the wars against the Republic, and it ends with Austria just having to admit defeat in Northern Italy, and Northern Italy falls to Revolutionary France under Napoleon.
This is at Campo Formio. What's funny is with this, I know we're going to finish up on this episode, but like, this is in 1797, and what he does without asking the Directorate back in Paris, he basically sets up. He's taken over Northern Italy. He's expelled the Austrians. He's confiscating Naples, Lombardy, all these areas, and he just creates like a new sister republic out of thin air. He's like,
asking permission. He just takes it on himself to create a new country.
And this is the Cisalpine Republic. He called it. You know what I mean? And he was like, and from now on, you will follow the same laws as in Republican France. You know, so he would export, you know, freedom of religion. For example, years later, and this is a good point on him, wherever he went, and this is why he's often called like the Enlightenment on horseback, despite, you know, he did a lot of bad things too, which we'll learn about. But wherever he went, he did like abolish discrimination for religion. Like, so he, for example, when he entered the Papal States years later, there was ghettos where the Jews were being kept and they had to wear the yellow star. This isn't Italy. Like, this isn't. And he abolished all
that.
He said, from now on, you can be whether you're a Catholic, a Protestant, a Muslim, a Jew. He's like, it doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean? So he did, despite the fact that he betrayed the revolution in a lot of ways, a lot of its most important gains, I suppose, in terms of, you know, equality before the law, religious tolerance, abolition of like feudal privileges. He did still integrate all those things into any territory he either took over or controlled as a vassal.
He would say liberated, but annexed.
Well, that's great. But he's getting used to making his own decisions quite early here. This is the Directorate, one would assume, who were like, this guy's great, let's send him off. That's kind of an interesting move. Not to mention then he obviously returns, the war is wrapped up, so he's returning to France then. And I would assume that people see him as a hero. He's done the impossible over there.
And he's scared of his life because he knows now that he's so popular that he could be bumped off. So he'd be, you know, he made sure not to go around in his military uniform once he returned to Paris. He'd only eat boiled eggs. because he knew that they couldn't be tampered with. You know, so he was
bearing in mind, as we said, he is a classical education. So what he's thinking now is Caesar.
Yeah.
Caesar returning to Rome, but without the legions. You got to be careful.
Yeah. You got to be careful. And what's he going to do next? Well, I think the contrast with the Directory is important here, right? Because they were not very popular at this stage. So,
and he's hatched a plan.
At any stage?
Yeah, at any stage.
None of the French government's problem.
Well, obviously, France is being invaded by all sides. Spain, Piedmont. Obviously, the British are continuing as well to interfere in their affairs.
And
there's rebellion.
And paying for other people to attack them, yeah.
Exactly. So they're extremely the Directory is extremely unpopular, and now Napoleon comes back with a little idea that he's had about how could we punish the British, and also, you know, for all of their intransigence, and how can we damage their trade, but also strengthen France, export the revolution, and also get rich. And that's where he thinks of Egypt.
So tune in next time.
Yeah, tune in next time as Napoleon heads to Egypt. That's it for now. It's not the end of the reel. We'll see you in Napoleon Part 2, Reign.
Au revoir.